This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family and friends, fans and fiends to the seventh edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I'm Benjamin Norris and this is a 16-week series where we're getting to know Australian LGBTI influencers. Each week, we sit down with those who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community. Today, our guest is an Australian TV presenter. He is currently the president of Midsummer, which is in full swing. He formed a relationship with arguably the world's most famous Real Housewife, Lisa Vanderpump from The Real Housewives. I don't know how that happened.
If that's my claim to fame.
It's not, but we throw it in there. This man is a spokesperson on bullying. He has openly handled conversations on depression and anxieties. He's been out to schools. He's discussed his personal stories on national TV programs. You may have seen him on Studio 10, and you're about to hear a whole lot more of him on Kiss FM with Zoe Marshall. Welcome to today's guest, and welcome to John Caldwell.
John Caldwell uses his past tragedies to teach really important lessons.
A filmmaker, an author, and an inspiration.
When I was 15, I had left school. I was homeless.
JC, who is now our weekly entertainment reporter.
He could be Australian of the Year.
Joining us now is our very own hack man, John Caldwell. Yay!
Is it weird when you get to hear all of that?
Well, it's weird to be on the other side of the microphone, actually, because I haven't done this for a while. But sometimes when you get really busy, you step back a little bit from some of the work you've done. And so when I just hear some of that, I'm like, oh, I really need to do a bit more of that again, and I need to get back onto that. So it's a little inspiring to hear it, actually.
I think we'd be really narcissistic if we sat down every day and played back the dot points of what we've done that have been successful. But in a way, it is that opportunity to look at that and reflect back and go, wow, I've achieved a lot.
Yeah, I'm going to play that every morning from now on. That's my alarm clock, your little intro there.
I'll record it on your phone. Morning, John. We're going to go back to the start because, like, talking about your personal story is really what has inspired me. And a lot of people out there probably see you out and about, see you on television or hear you on the radio and just think, wow, this guy is just such a confident person. He must have come from a particular upbringing. Where in actual fact, that's the best thing about you, is that your upbringing was a little bit more unusual, I'd say.
Yeah, completely. And I'm happy to get into that. But on that, I recently worked with somebody for quite a while who immediately took a dislike to me the moment I met this person. And nothing I could do, I genuinely try and go out of my way to make people happy and comfortable, and nothing I could do would get this person to like me. And I asked someone one day, I'm like, what have I ever done? And they said, oh, the first day you got here, you drove in your fancy car, and she said, oh, I can't stand people that were born with silver spoons in their mouth. So immediately decided she hated my guts because I was brought up wealthy. Little did she know or make any effort to go and actually look at how I actually was brought up. So,
and people like that is so strange to me because it makes me think that's quite a judgmental attitude to have.
Yeah, I was quite shocked by it. I mean, I take people at face value no matter what their upbringing was, but it was more shocking that she was completely wrong and didn't even make any inquiries before making up her mind about that.
Well, getting into that, you know, when you were growing up, like what were you like as a child?
I didn't know who I was because, you know, I grew up in, was born in the western suburbs of Sydney into a family where literally children should be seen and not heard was the slogan of the family. I had two alcoholic parents, a very, very violent father, and we didn't really get a right to determine anything about who we wanted to be or how we wanted to behave. It was very, very regimented on one hand in terms of sit there and shut up, but very unregimented in terms of there was no discipline around school or homework or anything like that. It was a very loose house. I think to be honest. Neither of my parents wanted children. They had three because that's what you do. And they stayed together because that's what you do, even though they hated each other. So it was a very unusual environment.
My first stepfather used to always say children were to be seen and not heard. And for me personally, I rebelled against it. Did it make you quiet or did it make you rebel against that?
I was horrendously quiet. I barely spoke. I barely spoke at home. I barely spoke at school. Nothing like what you see now. I had zero confidence, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, not even a 2 or 3, it was 0. So firstly, at home, obviously, I literally would just shut up. And I think that was a combination of, I mean, I'm a very big believer of, you know, who you are or that you're different from a young age. That's my personal story. My first ever sexual thought of any kind from a very young age was about men, not about women. So that, I think, made me shut up at home because I didn't want any of that to come across at all. And I didn't like my family. I didn't like my parents. I didn't like the way we lived. So I disengaged with them. But then you go to school with that lack of confidence. And I certainly, I mean, most of my schooling years up until high school, I had no friends, not one. So not even the nerdy kid in the corner who I could saddle up to. There was just nobody. So I think there probably would have been days where I might have said 3 or 4 words the whole day. And that was under duress because the teacher asked a question of me or something.
And then you felt like you were put upon. But interestingly, your parents did something a rather odd, I'm going to say. They bought a bus and then they went, basically, I think they loved Australia and they were going to just go around Australia. Is that right?
That was the plan. Look, I think it came more out of an avoidance of life. I don't think they wanted to work. I don't think they wanted to have any kind of traditional parenting situation or family, wider family. So it was really escapism. And we would just bundle onto this bus and we would go from town to town. And most of the time, again, I did say my dad was violent, and I meant very violent. So most of the time we'd be in a new town where we were going to live for a week, and he would get drunk and either have a fight with my mother where the neighbours would have to step in and break it up, or he'd have a fight with one of the neighbours and punch out the guy next door. So the next day we'd be bundled back onto the bus and we'd be off to the next town where nobody knows what happened. And that was a very repetitive cycle for us. That's just what life was like.
Where did you start from and go through to?
Yeah, this was sort of between the age of, I think it was between the age of probably 6 and 9. So I have recollections of where we were. I don't know. There wouldn't have necessarily been a cycle. Like, it wasn't like we're going to start here and go there. It was like, oh, we know some people in Adelaide, so we'd just go off to Adelaide and that would all blow up. So then we knew some people in Northern Territory, so we'd go up to Northern Territory.
Wow, so it was really just sporadic.
It was very sporadic. Yeah, there was no rhyme nor reason to any of it. So
when I first heard that story, I was thinking like the Partridge Family or something like that. And I guess that's not trying to romanticise the whole situation, but I just pictured you sort of going, oh, well, let's move on to the next place. Mm. And the hard thing about that is, for any children, they're looking for stability, and that stability wasn't there because you kept going to these new schools and being the kid with, you know, well, not wearing school uniform and finding it hard to fit in. I mean, are these the building blocks for how you have become so social, that you had so much pressure on yourself as a child that you really had to work out how to click with people?
Yeah, no. You would think so. You would think so. To the Partridge Family thing, a lot of people do romanticise it and think, but you were so lucky to have these experiences. I have to be honest, it just wasn't like that. So we would, yeah. Even when we went to somewhere, there's some spots I really remember, like Edith Falls in the Northern Territory. Mm. As children, we got off the bus, we saw it, we were lumped back onto the bus. We would stay there and our parents would take their esky and their beers and they would go down and swim in the falls and we would stay on the bus. So there was nothing glamorous about it. I think as an adult there is. How wonderful to travel the country and see these beautiful scenes. But we were not allowed to experience or enjoy that. We would just be sitting on a hot bus playing some Uno game or something like that. So there just wasn't that romantic side of it.
There's nothing glamorous about sitting on a bus while your parents go swimming in a waterhole.
Nothing. And I guess what frustrates me about that is knowing how beautiful the country is. At some point I would like to go and retrace some of those steps myself as an adult and actually experience it, because we just didn't get to do that.
What is the dynamics within your siblings?
I have 2 older sisters.
Okay.
Yeah, very, very different. And I think, you know, I guess, I mean, I love them dearly, so I certainly don't want to be bagging them, but my sisters have both followed in the same footsteps as my parent. I went completely the other way. So to your question, I guess, about that being the building blocks, it really wasn't. In fact, I was homeless at 15 and I left home at 15. And then I decided I had to become this person. I had to develop this personality that just didn't exist. So no, it was quite the opposite. I mean, the upbringing pushed me down further and made me shut up more and made me not engage with people. And I think going from school to school, it wasn't like you go in and you want to make friends. You get to a point where you know you're not going to make friends. So you go in and you avoid having to talk to anyone ever because they're not going to like you. They're not going to like the gypsy from the bus who is the only one wearing something different to them. Quite often the only kid without shoes on at a school. No backpack, no lunchbox, all the things that you're supposed to just have, we just didn't have. And it wasn't through complete lack of money. I think the money that we had was just prioritised on beer and alcohol and social entertainment. So, yeah, no, I think that it didn't and I have thought long and hard, should I give my parents any credit? And I've come to a very clear conclusion that no, they don't get any credit for at all what I've become.
And one of the things that you and I both share, which is kind of, it's a heartbreaking element to our story, is that we both lost our father a certain way. Your father, he committed suicide when you were 12, is that right?
11, yeah.
11. Mm-hmm. Now, what did that do, though, to you? I mean, I know what it did to me, but I don't know what it did to you at that age.
I think maybe, fortunately and unfortunately, that whole way that we were brought up, I think in this case, in some ways it helped. And it helped that nobody cared how I felt. Nobody, I think, you know, as it happened, I was actually there. I didn't see it, but I heard it. And my mother, in her wisdom, ran out, instead of trying to deflect from it, said, he's just shot himself, to her 11-year-old son. And then told me to go and get help, which I did. And then we were on holidays at my grandmother's, and then the whole family came running out, and then my grandmother fainted and everyone ran to help her. So as an 11-year-old, I'm sitting there quite stunned about what's going on around me. And at no point, whether it was that day or a week later or a month later, there was never a sit-down discussion with me at any point by anyone about what I heard, what I saw, how I felt. I think in some ways that helped, because you just weren't given the opportunity to be upset or to grieve or to process. You just got on with it. So while it's terrible, and I don't think any child should be treated that way through something like that, that's probably why I didn't really ever have to deal with it. And I think the other thing, and it is really sad to say, but it is a reality, is I just didn't have a positive relationship with my father at all. So I don't think there came a time, whether it was 5 years later or 10 years later, or there never came a time where I had to emotionally deal with the baggage of it, because
even
it,
now
it didn't. It just doesn't really affect me. I don't think, to me, my father was just another person. And I guess somewhere in my subconscious, perhaps because I think when someone who I've met once passes away, that really upsets me more than other people. So I think death upsets me more than other people. But I don't have that deep-seated desire to deal with anything around my father's death, which is and I don't think it's something that's bottled up or that just is going to come out one day. You know, we just didn't really care for each other that much. So, yeah.
From that age, you then moved into foster care, is that right?
Well, I had a stepfather first, so my mother moved on relatively quickly, as you do, and he moved into our house, and he was... I think, you know, as a child, watching your mother get beaten up and treated awfully by your dad is a really horrible thing. But I never was. So my father never laid a hand on me. That changed. Suddenly, my mother never had a hand laid on her, and I did. So I had the stepfather who would bully me, pick on me, hit me, you know, right down to we would have movie nights, which we'd never had as a family. So you'd think that was going to be great. But he would have me sit at his feet like a dog, and he would have lollies and popcorn and chips, and he would drop one down occasionally on the floor like I was the dog and let me have one lolly, and then, you know, send me off to bed when his daughter, 2 years younger than me, would stay up as long as she wanted. So life sort of took that turn from bad to worse, where suddenly the people around me weren't hurting, which was great, but I was the target. And that was solely because this gentleman always wanted a boy. He had three girls, and then he got me, and I wasn't exactly the picture-perfect rugby-playing boy that he wanted. So, yeah, that was his way of dealing with that.
Well, look at you now. Look at the size of your arms now.
We're getting there.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, it's so funny that back in those days, looking for stereotypical boys or girls is a pressure that is enormous for children. For anyone that's putting pressure on their children to fit a stereotype, especially for gay boys, I mean, I was a very effeminate boy myself, it's a stress. And there's a pressure that was put on there. Did you put that pressure on yourself?
The pressure I put on myself was just to hide everything and to keep it a secret. Like I never pretended to be anything else. I just hid from everyone. Mm. And, you know, I know, and we will talk about this no doubt later, but I know with the whole marriage equality debate that came up, people are like, oh, you must be so happy. And I said, I'm so happy for the 11 or 12-year-old me living in country New South Wales or country Victoria who genuinely believes if anybody finds out what I am, I'm going to have to commit suicide, which I did at that age. Mm. I thought there was no way anyone could know that I was gay. And if they did, I would have to end my life. And, you know, I've never talked about this story ever publicly, but we lived in a caravan park and, you know, I was 12 years old and I had a little peek under the showers one day at who was in the next shower and I got caught. And I genuinely ran off thinking, I don't even know how to kill myself, but I have to because he saw me and he's going to tell people and my parents are going to find out. And it's such a horrific feeling. And to think about, yes, we've come a long way, but in a lot of ways we haven't come a long way. And I think still in the areas where I grew up, these kids are still feeling that way. And that was the pressure I put on myself, was thinking death was a better option than someone finding out how I was born.
Sally Rugg, when I was talking to her, she was saying that she wants to get to a point where there's no children feeling like that. And I think going back to that, having a peek under the shower is really not the worst thing in the world. Was there any ramifications in the end of that?
I mean, it's probably not ideal to be peeking under the shower.
Well, I'm not condoning perverts. No, I'm only kidding. You know, I'm not condoning the peeping Tom. But, like, I think at some points when you're struggling for role models or you're struggling to find your identity as a child, it's curiosity.
Hmm. The ramifications were that the person did know who I was and did go and tell my mother, and she just completely never raised it. So it was never discussed, which in itself was so much better than what I thought would happen. Mm. And to be honest, I don't even know what I thought would happen. I just knew it would be the end of the world, and that's literally how I felt. So
I think there's so many people listening to this right now and they think to themselves, God, that happened to me. A lot of LGBTI people growing up, you know, would have shared a very similar story with that and had that belief.
What I think is funny about that is as I've gotten older and I've heard other stories, that is curiosity. And I think there's plenty of straight heterosexual men out there who've probably had a peek under the shower when they were 11 or 12 years old as well, or had a peek at something. Or, I mean, it's just general curiosity of a child. But when you know that you're harboring this secret, it escalates that in your mind to something, you know, detrimental.
Or you're terrified. Mm. You know, there's a personality that I think that we have, like who we are when we're younger. And I think that sort of changes into our adult life. Would you say that you were thrown off course from who you were as a child to who you are now by your sexuality?
Yeah. I think the attributes were always there. I just hid them. And I think what I love about aging, and there's not a whole heap of things, but one of those things is all the things that I hated about myself, I now love about myself. All the things that I tried to bury about myself are the very things that make me successful now. Mm. That's got to be one of the biggest lessons I've learned in life. And I do say that to kids when I talk to them at school now, is all the things you're getting picked on are probably going to make you money one day or make you more popular one day. Or
yeah.
So, you know, had I known that then, maybe I wouldn't have been the most unpopular kid in school. Maybe I wouldn't have been the quietest and the shyest and buried all these attributes. But I did, because they made you realize, they would have made people realize maybe that I was gay.
But that's your journey. Like, as in, I wouldn't, these things that have happened to you, that we've talked about some pretty dark issues, but they've shaped you to this person that you are, and you're quite a remarkable person. Would you ever take anything back?
Yeah, I'd take heaps of it back. Heaps of the childhood stuff. And I think, you know, I alluded to it before, it wasn't that a lot of those things shaped me. It was literally, there was just a turning point in my life where I thought, I need to understand what the rest of the world does, how they behave, mm-hmm. So it was literally like I took all those experiences, put them in a bag and dumped them in a river, and then went, how does everybody else live life? My sisters, who went through all the same experiences as me, let them shape them and followed on that journey. So that's why I say, you know, I don't think they did make me the person I am. I think trying to put them out of my mind, which I did for a long time, didn't think about them, didn't talk about them, and forgetting about them and trying to start all over and experience new things is what shaped who I am now. But I think once you sort of find who you are, then you can go back into the river and get some of those things back and I guess deal with them for yourself, but also help other people deal with similar things who maybe didn't have the strength to move on the way that I did.
If you had the opportunity to go and sit down right now with 12-year-old John, and it's hard to sort of think of off the bat What do you think he'd say?
Probably tell him peeking under the shower is not the best option.
Take that one back.
What I said before, you know, I think the things that you are trying to hide and that you're embarrassed about now, maybe if you feel you need to, still do them, still hide them, because that's how you're coping. But don't think that that's how it's always going to be, because they are the very things that will be your character in the end that will help you. I think I'd also say maybe don't sweat the small stuff as much. You know, it isn't actually the end of the world if somebody finds out some of these things. And I really don't know if that would get through to someone of that age, because you do genuinely feel that way. I mean, I hope that the more we talk about these stories, the more they see it, the more it's normalized, the more, you know, people, gay people are getting married. I think that will naturally, very slowly, probably not for many, 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 many years, it will slowly in their mind start to normalize that and take that fear away.
You ended up finding a home in retail and hospitality as you were getting older and sort of finding a career for yourself. What was it about retail and hospitality that clicked so well with John Caldwell?
It was easy to get. That was a good start.
Well, you didn't end up finishing high school, so you sort of went into wanting to work and have an independent life.
Yeah. That was one thing. There was three things I thought would set me apart from my family. I was never going to smoke, I was never going to drink, and I was going to finish school.
How did you go with those?
I've never smoked. That's all.
Just going to keep the balls on it. But everything in moderation.
That's right.
Okay.
I'd already left home. I was in foster care in really, really bad areas. And I was only in year nine, and I was one of the areas I was terrible at was mathematics. I was just really, really bad at it. And again, coming from that, growing up being so petrified, I was more afraid of trying than actually being wrong. So often I just wouldn't even try. This last year of school, I was in the worst mathematics class, and I thought, I need to get this right. I need to nail it. I worked really, really, really hard. Well, one of the boys in our terrible class hit the teacher. And this whole class had been in trouble for many, many things. And so they basically came in and said, we're failing this entire class. You're all out of control. And this was when I'd really worked my butt off and thought, I'm going to make a difference. And I thought, I just lost all faith in the education system at that point. I thought, we didn't even get to sit the final exam. Yeah. We all failed without sitting the exam. So I left school immediately. I thought, there's just no point. Like, you know, I'm living in foster care. I'm working as well. I was working after school, and then I'd go to a night job, and then I'd have a weekend job. So I just gave up and went into the workforce. My first actual job before retail was in a call center.
How did that go?
It was a huge turning point for me because I was only, you know, 16 years old then, and I nailed it. It was selling, if I recall rightly, it was selling listings in the business and fax directory.
Oh, wow.
I know, right? Not even the yellow pages.
Yeah.
Truth be told, I think I might have tailored my script in a way that people thought it was the yellow pages. I'm not sure. But I did very, very well. There was a team of 100, and this is the kid who was so shy, and I think I loved that I was suddenly on a phone and nobody knew who I was or what I was.
Yeah.
So I just suddenly opened up and became this whole other person. And I became the number one out of the 100 in the call center of selling, which was remarkable to me.
Do you think, though, like from just a small thing that you said there, do you think it's a coping mechanism or a tactic that you picked up that instead of sort of being homed by the truth, you learned how to sort of bend it just a little bit to get the job done?
Yeah, I think I kind of skate on the
edge. This is Saturday Sessions.
I don't think I'd do that again in my wisdom. I mean, that, you know, that was, I genuinely at that point was probably intentionally misleading people. But, I guess I didn't really know much better at that time. I'd been brought up where, you know, crime paid,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly. But
you know, you kind of realise as you get a bit older that there are other ways to be successful without misleading people.
The reason why I bring that up, though, is that I think of myself, and I think sometimes when we grow up as gay boys, or, you know, we're so fearful of the truth within ourselves, I did come up with a coping mechanism to sort of live on the side of fantasy to a certain element to get the job done.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I think even still now in my life, you know, to work in this industry that we work in, it's a difficult industry to work in, and you certainly have to not oversell yourself, but you certainly have to make your point of difference more glamorous than it probably really is.
Yeah, I think rather than being dishonest, it's more like PR. So you might put a spin on things rather than
being
dishonest.
We just totally offended everyone that's ever worked in PR. Or
we love you, PR people. Thank you for getting me here.
But you get what I'm talking about.
Totally. Yeah. No, I think, look, I definitely still have a spin that I might put on things, but it would never be to be dishonest or to deceive people or to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, anyone listening who says, well, I'm not like that, you're a liar. We all have social media. We all, you know, polish up our photos. We all show just the best parts of ourselves. And I think that's what you're talking about. Mm. It used to be just limited to people who maybe had something to hide or to cover up. Or now it's kind of just the way of the world. People just put their best foot forward, and it's kind of just like sales, really. You just polish
up. Why shouldn't you?
Everyone wants to polish that turd now.
Going from that to sort of getting into your first media experience, what was that?
My first media experience, I've probably done little tiny bits and pieces for my jobs on the way through. Nothing major, just little bits.
Yeah.
My first, I guess, commercial media experience was probably through charity work. So it was really through representing some of the charities that I support. And that's, I mean, it's really only been in the last 6 years, and that's how that started. It was just going on to promote causes and to help organisations is how that started.
Bullying and depression were sort of the homes of that, right?
Yeah, that was where it really started. So bullying and depression, which sort of just then led to obviously Alana and Madeline, which is one of my chosen organisations, which was more around taking that another step further and looking at protection of children holistically. And that's quite organic for me because, you know, bullying was certainly the biggest thing that affected me growing up, but then take that a step further and you're then looking at exactly who I was as a kid, a child that's, you know, in a violent environment with alcoholic parents, displaced from home from time to time, and that's why it became a bit more holistic. So bullying is just part of what that problem was.
Not to quote Oprah, you know, but she says speak your truth and share your story. And it's funny because, like, she's just recently come out with this. Maybe it's a mantra she's had for a long time, but she's just publicly come out with this. That's also your mantra,
yeah.
You know, to share your story.
Yeah,
you know.
And to speak your truth. I think to that end, well, after I sort of, I guess, found some success and made some money, I just wanted to give back, and I think people feel that a lot. So the first thing I did was a volunteer trip to South Africa. You know, that's quite glamorous. Everyone wants to do that. And it actually was fantastic. But, you know, 12 months later, I found myself right back again going, oh, well, that's over and what am I doing now? And that's when I realised that's not my truth. You know, I didn't grow up in South Africa. I don't really assimilate to those people. So I thought, well, what affected me growing up? And that's when I guess, became a little addicted to charity work and organisations was when I suddenly connected with what it really meant to me. And it wasn't just a, you should because it's a nice thing to do, give part of your income away. It was a, oh, wait, this is a way of dealing with what I went through by helping other people and actually people I understand that what they're going through. And that's where Alana and Madeline, you know, for 5-6 years and I have had a very strong relationship and get stronger all the time because I get these people.
So I guess that's where it all comes through to sort of working in media is that, you know, work on these sorts of working with these sorts of organisations, sharing your story. Eventually you got nominated for Australian of the Year. You won for Victoria.
Correct, yeah.
But then you became nominated for Australian of the Year.
Yes.
I guess that really catapulted you at a time. And was that sort of when you ended up on Studio 10 talking about it?
Yeah, so I was doing quite a lot of programs at the time, and I think White Ribbon was domestic violence against women was the other topic I talked about a lot. What I found was I really loved it, but it was never something in my wildest dreams I thought I could do as a job coming from my background.
Yeah.
But two, I was getting really good feedback. The producer go, that was an excellent segment. I go, great, when can I come on again? They said, oh, no. Not until somebody dies from a partner or a child commits suicide for bullying. We can't talk about this again. So it really annoyed me, I'll say, because we're on radio, that these topics that were so dear to my heart, nobody wanted to talk about until there was a tragedy. So,
but isn't it funny that that was going on for a very long time?
It was. It was. And, you know, I think in the mainstream media, I really pushed hard to overcome that. So I thought, well, how can I do this? And so I thought, well, I mean, I've always loved entertainment. I love celebrity gossip. And
no.
So I thought, well, I'm getting this feedback that they thought I was good at presenting and they enjoyed having me on the show. And so I had some additional training to polish up on that. And then I started to personally take that persona and use social media to show an interest in that. And then I went back and pushed myself on these networks that already said I was doing a good job. So there was two reasons I wanted to do that. One is I absolutely, unashamedly thought this could be a new career for me. The other was that if I could build a profile that people knew who I was and I actually got more screen time for whatever, then when I wanted to talk about my issues, I didn't have to wait for somebody to die. And it has worked that way. You know, I think on whether it's Kiss or whether it's on Studio 10, yes, I'm there for a certain topic or a certain reason, but they give me complete free range to talk at the end of that about anything that I want to. And I have regularly talked about the causes. Anytime Alana and Madeline have a gala or a fundraiser or an initiative, I always get to promote that. So, you know, it's worked really well for that. And the bonus is I got a career out of it.
Which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a roundabout way of doing it. I think if there was a generic path that people could take, there'd be a whole lot of people trying to take it. Mm. But at the same time, you know, by you just being who you are, that sort of led you to these roles.
And I just think that's brilliant. I think people often say to me, oh, how did you do that? I want to do that. And authenticity is the key.
Yeah.
I didn't do it thinking I'm going to get a radio show one day. I did it because I just like playing in radio and TV, and I had a message that I wanted to get out there. So I think if you can do something from the heart and be authentic about it, since you like quoting people, as Dr. Phil says, be your authentic self, that is the only difference. And I think because I was so passionate about pushing that message, I just pushed myself as well.
Was it sort of after that, because this was where I first came across you, I saw a photo with you with Lisa Vanderpump. And how did that opportunity come about? I mean, were you hired to do that set project, or did you just present that to someone?
Back in those days, I was doing a lot of my own scouting. So it was for Studio 10. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I had at that point is I did have a regular spot on Studio 10. So I was fortunate enough that I had that brand. And then my own team or myself would reach out when I was traveling and suggest interviews. And that was one where we just put it out there and she's like, yep. We actually pitched it as a at home with Lisa Vanderpump, and it was quite exciting. I was in LA. I was actually Eileen Davidson's doing her, who, you know, she's all right. And I got the call saying, yep, Lisa wants you. It's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. You have to be here at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. It's like,
wow.
Oh crap. So, you know, time difference. I have to call the network, see if they can find a crew, et cetera, et cetera. But it was, I mean, that's the other thing. Yes, that's one that you've seen. I mean, I would have traveled and pitched 100 of those to get that one. So again, people are like, oh, you did it so easily, why can't we do that? It's like there was nothing easy about it. So
it's again and again, when you're working in media and you think you see people interviewing someone, you think, oh, that probably came about. But I get it, because I've done that before. You know, there's so much pitching going on.
Mm.
But I mean, you've definitely spoken to the cream of the crop. I mean, you've done Kim Kardashian, Angelina Jolie. You know, you've sat down with some of the, I would say, unattainable stars and had an opportunity to put a bit of yourself into it, but make that something accessible for other people, which is a talent.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is, you know, you've got to, I like to think, this probably has come from my upbringing, I say I'm a bit of a hustler. I think I like to hustle, and I'm on 24/7. It's not a job for me, it's a passion. So when you're doing that and you're making connections constantly, things will come back to you. But if you sit there and you go, this is my job, and from 8:30 to 5:30, I'm going to go and give it all I've got, and well, then you're going to get, you know, a mediocre return rate on your investment. So for me, it was just on all the time. And Kim Kardashian was a great one. That came through a friend of mine, at the time was more of an acquaintance, who I had just kept in touch with regularly, put positive things out to, helped wherever I could. I haven't really even promoted this, but it was the first interview she did anywhere in the world after her paper magazine naked shoot that broke the internet. She flew straight to Australia after that and hadn't done any media. Because this person had never really managed that caliber of celebrity, was managing this interview process, he said, do you want to do the interview? And you can be the first person. So you can imagine you've got, you know, the likes of Richard Wilkins watching me stroll down the hallway in for the global breaking interview with Kim Kardashian.
How did that go down?
Not well.
You're still fairly gracious with this sort of stuff, though. I mean, you're like, at the same time, you give Richard Wilkins a wave or whoever.
But
I mean,
of course.
What he wouldn't know, what people may not know, is how much work goes into those moments. And it's luck, chance and circumstance. But, you know, there's a fair amount of work that gets you just to that point.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's probably, you know, I don't grudge anybody, but I think that's one of the things that does frustrate me, is that persona or the perception that I've just waltzed in here in the last 5 years and have this job. And it's really, it's because of the amount of work I'd put in. And I I know I will continue to always do that. And, you know, I go to interviews where, as you would know, they say no personal questions. And, you know, I won't mention names, but I recently did one with a huge celebrity and they said no personal questions. And somebody who I respect and admire in the industry was on before me, and their interview was cut off after they asked the first personal question. They were asked to leave because there was no personal questions.
Wow.
I walked in straight after that and I asked dozens of personal questions, including this was pre-marriage equality, asked about their stance on that, got them to do a piece to camera campaigning to Malcolm Turnbull on why it should be changed, and I wasn't asked to leave.
This interview is not fun if you don't tell us who that person is.
Justin Timberlake was the celebrity. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Was he a good interview?
He was fantastic, yeah.
How did you end up with this job for Kiss? Because I know, and everyone knows, that you've been on Kiss FM for quite a long time now, you know, doing your entertainment stuff. So the show that you're doing this year is Celeb HQ.
Yes.
So was this a brainchild of yours, or did they come to you and be like, John, you've been doing such a great job, how can you do something for us?
But it's somewhere in the middle of those two. I think being national entertainment for Kiss has been, you know, as you said, I've got to do some incredibly good interviews. I think what we had up until recently was really embedded long-term shows who probably had such strong anchors that they would just play snippets of those interviews because it was their shows rather than whole interviews. Obviously, we've had a bit of a shake-up of talent on our network this year, so that's obviously going to change. But more importantly, we just saw that there was another vehicle that we could create to use these interviews, utilise these interviews. And, you know, entertainment, whether it's radio or TV, is just becoming a bigger component of what they're doing. So it just kind of made sense that, you know, they had the resource in me. Why not utilize it a little more?
It's a really good direction to take it. I mean, Kyle and Jax, they've been there doing their breakfast show and their brand is to sort of stay with entertainment. Is that changing the network in a way to move away from talking more about lifestyle and talking more about the fun, entertainment, the gossip? I mean, is that staying with that brand?
To me, it just makes sense. I think, you know, all of the TV and radio networks are putting a lot more focus on entertainment. I think as consumers, we're buying more of the magazines, we're reading more of the mail online, we're, you know, we're wanting to consume more of this stuff. So if anything, it was kind of a bit of a gap, I think, where we weren't talking about more of it. So it's obviously, it is a bit of a change in strategy, but I think it's what people want.
From doing entertainment, you know, which you've done very well, and it's all sort of cosmically, I think, come together as much as you've worked at it. How did you end up rise to the ranks of becoming the president of Midsummer?
That was the same, almost the identical story as the media. You know, when I was Australian of the Year for Victoria, I was asked to be what they had then was champion, like ambassador for the year. I did that. Guilty as charged. I really didn't know much about Midsummer at the time. I knew it was a great carnival and a pride march. Woohoo, don't we all? I did not know that it was 22 days. I did not know that it was a very impressive arts and culture festival. So that year, being involved in that way, forced me to see what it was. And I became very passionate about it to the point where I asked if I could join the board, and they said yes. I think, you know, like a lot of community organisations, the board was made up of really impressive, passionate, engaged community members, but probably lacked commerciality in order to make sure that it was being run financially viably and that it had longevity. Circumstance, within a few months of me being on the board, the chair at the time wanted to step down to have a family. Just because of my commercial background, you know, I was voted to take over that. And then I think probably what I did was apply a commercial acumen to it. The training that I had to undertake was realize that you can't run a community organization just like a business. So it was 50-50. You know, I had to learn how to engage with the community and how you can't just bulldoze things through when you want them. But the other side is this organization, which, you know, it's probably no secret, probably was coming close to the end of its lifespan in terms of being financially viable. You know, having taken on Pride March 3 years earlier with no funding, no ability to raise extra money for that, it just wasn't viable for it to continue. So, you know, what Midsummer taught me was how to run a community organisation and how to understand, I guess, the emotion that a community organisation will bring with it. And the other side is, in I was able to put in the commercial acumen into the organisation, and it's now, you know, financially very viable. So
what's the particular thing that you've brought to the table? Like, what is it that you can say, we're in the middle of this, people would know this, you know?
Well, the biggest thing I have brought to the table is, I guess, that the increase in sponsorship, both from corporates and government and the financial side. So, you know, we're set up for at least another 3 years funding. We've been able to fund actually having a team, which we really didn't have before. And therefore, that has a flow-on effect. You know, with having that team, we can support the community. We can produce events or co-produce events.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I feel like at this particular point of our lives, a part of the LGBTI community, people like official sponsor with NAB, you know, they are wanting to include themselves with the LGBTI people. There's a real desire for big brands to want to connect with the LGBTI community, and this is just the perfect opportunity for them to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what we had to be very careful of from the beginning, though, was the big brands that want to be seen to be engaging versus the big brands that want to be engaging. And, you know, you don't always get that right. I think we're very confident that all of our current sponsors genuinely want to be engaged with our community, and we know this because their activations are not just come to Carnival, whack up a stall. You know, some have got billboards around the city. NAB are putting up on all of their ATMs a message about Midsummer throughout the festival. They're asking us to be more engaged with them. They're asking us to go out and talk to their pride networks. Some, you know, some who are relatively new in this space are asking us to help them set up a pride network because they don't have one. That's okay. You don't have to be perfect. You have to want to be on that journey and have to want to partner with our community. And so there is certainly nobody on our sponsors list who just write a check once a year and we don't hear from them again anymore. So that's something to be really proud of as well.
Is this something that you're going to continue on? I mean, is this like an opportunity to do this now and just be like, and leave an impact on it now? Or
I would probably have major FOMO if I left anytime soon. But yeah, we haven't kind of resolved within me what I'm going to do about that yet.
If you came back and did this next year, what would you do that was different?
There's always stuff to do differently. There's always absolute improvements. I mean, this was my third carnival. I think if you've seen each one over the last three, there's been massive changes. I would say this is probably the one where there's the smallest amount of change to make. I think the movement that's happened over the last three has been quite phenomenal. From a consumer perspective or an organisation, there's not a whole lot that would make sense to people that I say I would change. It's a lot of back-end stuff, a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that would just make the running a little smoother and, yeah.
Well, moving on to the LGBTI landscape that we're in at the moment, you know, coming off the back of the plebiscite, can I ask you, because a lot of people talked about the plebiscite and how hurtful it was, and it was an incredibly hurtful thing for a lot of people to go through. What was your experience? I mean, I know some people said they went into a bubble and it didn't hurt them. I know some people have said that they knew people that lost their lives, but I want to know, what was your experience with the plebiscite?
I couldn't go into a bubble because I'm so surrounded by it in everything that I do. I will say that I probably focused on the positives a little more than some, and that's not right or wrong, but I was, again, surrounded by people like Kyle Sanderlands, who's the most unassuming person to be a spokesperson, but was one of our biggest media spokespeople for the Yes campaign. And seeing people like that who haven't really got any particular reason to engage or to be, but they did, and they really, really pushed for that. So that, I guess, helped. I did find it astoundingly upsetting, and I'm surprised that I did, because normally I'm a big believer in you just push forward, you make shit happen, and you focus on what you need to focus on. But it just got so divisive that it was very hurtful, and I couldn't help but feel emotional, like I said before, for the children out in the suburbs. And I think what affected me the most was knowing that we just come so far in terms of, I feel like people like my parents would be out in the suburbs saying to their kid, oh, I don't like the gays, but whatever, look, they're here now, they're here to stay. This took them back to, no, they're not, they're wrong. And so it almost opened the can of worms that, while hadn't been accepted, had kind of just been, it's the norm now, we've just got to deal with it. But suddenly, you know, you've got your politicians on national television saying it's wrong and it's sick and it's perverted and they're all pedophiles. It re-engaged a debate that had just gone a bit quiet, thankfully. Yeah, I found it very hurtful, and I think, you know, this is not an uncommon story. I've heard it so many times, but I did cry when they said it was a yes, and I shocked myself that I cared that much. Not that I cared that much, but that it affected me that much.
I have to say that I have the story, and that was that it happened, and I think a lot of the media was sitting there ready to call people. National magazine rang me 30 seconds after it had been announced, and I hadn't had time for it to sink in, and they were just already doing an interview with me, wanting to just gather what I had to say about it, and I started crying a second into the interview, and I was so embarrassed and I just didn't know what to do that I just continued the interview and cried for about 5 minutes of this interview. And I got off the phone and I was like, that was the weirdest experience of my life, because I'm not that sort of an emotional person, but I felt really overwhelmed.
I absolutely agree, and I think I had my cry, and then I went the opposite. I then went and got on with my day because I was kind of numb to it all, and my own network called and said, we want you to get some recordings while you're out celebrating on Oxford Street with all the people at the party you're at. And I'm absolutely. Like, no, I'm in my office and I'm working and I really don't want to be bothered. I kind of was so numb that I just didn't engage with anything for the rest of that day. So I think everyone obviously handled it differently by the, 100,000 odd people on Oxford Street. That's what some did. But it was just, I think, because it had affected me so much deeper than I thought, that I just, I wanted some alone time for the rest of that day.
It is overwhelming. Mm. I mean, that's exactly what happened to a lot of people. What do you think about now? I mean, there's still a big journey for the LGBTI landscape. I mean, what are some of the hurdles that you see that we're going to face?
The biggest hurdle, I think, on the flip of that is that it's been a yes vote. So many people will go, oh, tick that box, the gays are happy, off we go, everything's normal. Well, it's not normal. I mean, it's almost tokenism to me. Like, it's great and it's a huge milestone, but it's marriage equality. It's not equality by no stretch of the imagination. I had an interview with a journalist from a gay publication not so long ago. She came to my office. We're sitting in the eastern suburbs of Sydney having a lovely coffee, and she made the comment, but isn't it great that life for children like you were isn't like that anymore? And I said, well, no, it's not sitting here in the eastern suburbs of Sydney, but go out to Mount Druitt to the high school and tell me kids are still not getting beaten up, getting called a poof or a fag or whatever we were called at the time, because it's absolutely still happening. So I think because it's become so, I guess, normalised in the areas where we are or where gay publications are or the television personalities who are happy and accepting it, we think that it's changed completely across the country, and there's no way. Like, we've got to think this is, it's more than just these pockets of where we are or the people listening to this podcast. There's still a huge problem for equality. And, I get backlash for this all the time, but I'm going to be really honest. I do not feel comfortable walking down the street holding hands with a partner. Still don't feel that it's accepted. I wear 3/4 pants down the street and I still get looked at astonishingly by people. Like, so I think if you're not in this position, you're hearing it so often talked about that you think, oh, well, they've got everything they wanted. By no stretch of the imagination, when I can't wear something that skirts on the edge of fashion, people look at me like I'm a weirdo, or hold hands with someone, or doesn't even have to be a partner, another male just touching them on the shoulder in public, you will still get looked at strangely by people.
That is still a big obstacle. I mean, it's not going to change overnight. I did hear a story about someone in Sydney, a younger boy that went out to a gay nightclub, and afterwards he was like, well, this has just happened, so I can walk home safely, and then found themselves in a predicament. And it was like, well, people still need to remember that, yes, it was a huge approval rate, but, there is an enormous approval. There was a lot of people that still said no, and we have to be respectful of those people. What do you have to say to those people out there that are still, grieving a no vote?
Look, I don't even think it's just them. I think we have to also remember that if you only had to read or listen to any of the radio stations to some of the yes voters who said, let them do what they want. They're not accepting of who we are. They're not accepting of you wearing what you want to wear or holding hands with what you want to. Thank you to them for voting and letting them do what they want to do, but we're still them. We're still that second class of citizen who they're like, oh, if they want to marry, let them marry, as long as they don't do any of that gay shit around me. Like, I heard these comments, It's not normalised. It's just that they didn't really care one way or another, so they're like, let them do what they want. So we still have to understand that there's a huge part of that yes vote that don't understand what being gay is, that think it's a choice, and that don't want to see any of this in front of them or around them at all.
For a huge part of Australia that did vote yes, they felt as though it was like, yes, I approve gay people. And then the one thing I noticed after that was that the LGBTI community felt grateful, but then some of the minorities within our own LGBTI felt left out and there was a bit of exclusion there. You know, so for some people, they're like, that's okay for this gay and gay person to get married, but they're still struggling with intersex or they're still struggling with bisexual people. What do you think we need to do now to become more accepting of LGBTI across the landscape?
It's going to be a very long road, and I think we're kidding ourselves if we think anything else. You know, I think if you think about the typical heterosexual person in the suburbs, they're just getting their head around a gay man or a lesbian woman, you know. And so, I mean, how long has that taken? We need to understand. It's not acceptable, but it is going to take that amount of time. I think what we have to do is continually push for it. I think we are at risk, and, you know, for those, I guess, minorities within our community, that they're not going to like this statement, but we are at risk when we hit a milestone and we say, well, that's not enough straight away, of people tuning out completely on all of what we're trying to push through.
Well, you don't want to be that, but then you also don't want to be complacent.
Yeah. So I think it is a matter of saying, as you and I have just said, great, thank you for marriage equality. Now we have to continue our journey.
And there's still more work to be done.
A whole lot more work to do. And I think, you know, it is one of the things as the chair of an LGBTI organisation that worries me, whether it's sponsorship or government funding, or it worries me that people are going to go, well, what's there left to fight for? You've got what you want. Why do you need a pride march now? Because you got marriage equality. Yeah. And, you know, marriage equality, yes, last year that was the theme of Pride March for the first time since we've taken it over. And that's only because it was such a big issue of the time.
Yeah.
But Pride March has always been a different theme around equality in general, and it will continue to be that. And I don't think in my lifetime there's not going to be a need for a Pride March. Trust me, the happiest thing I would ever be able to do is shut down the whole organisation because we no longer need to fight for equality. But that's not going to happen
in my
time.
We're going to miss out on a gay party.
No, we don't
want to
miss
out on the gay party.
Exactly.
You know, like, I think
we do like it.
It's about being positive, I would say. Interesting question for you, being in the fields that you work in. Do you think that now that a marriage equality has happened and the yes vote was successful, do you think we'll see entertainment people or sports people being more comfortable and being out about their sexuality? Have we changed that?
No. I think it goes back to what I said before. It's not about what the vote was or what the general consensus is. I think it's, you know, sports personalities and movie stars. It's about general acceptability. And, you know, I still believe that the biggest part of our population want to believe that their action hero is a big, butch, straight, burly man, not that he's a gay man wearing a costume. And it's sad, but it's true. We can't distinguish between the actor and the character. And that's, you know, that's just a reality. So,
but what about someone like Troye Sivan? Like, Troye Sivan is, you know, out and about and he's gay and he still have his female following.
Yeah, I think it, yes. And I think, you know, it depends on how that's marketed and how that's set up. And, you know, he's got an incredibly beautiful voice that is going to touch people anyway. Mm. I think a lot of male musicians like that, though, their following starts a lot from, you know, they're marketed to teenage girls. They're marketed as the hot young boy that everybody wants to be with. So, yeah, there's definitely, like, let's say, not that he is, but if Justin Bieber came out now, I don't think that would damage his popularity at all. I think every single girl on the planet would still want to sleep with him. Every gay boy already does. Well, I shouldn't say that.
I think they're going to get a lot of support.
Look, I think they'll get a lot of support on the surface. I don't know that they'll get a deep level of support. I think a lot of their fans probably won't understand it. And I do think there's such a long way to go before all of their players are going to be comfortable in the locker room with them, because they've got this stupid thought that because he's gay, he of course likes every single one of them and would jump them at any second. The sad part is I don't know if an AFL or any sports player, high profile one, came out. I think they would get an enormous amount of support. I don't know how long their career would last, and that's my genuine belief.
And that would be their fear as well.
It's horrific, but that's me with my head out of the sand being really honest about how I think that would go.
Over the next couple of years, what do you think you'll do as a contribution to the LGBTI community to help us progress in a way that makes people more acceptable?
I think, you know, the platforms that I've created, I will continue to use those for whatever I need to. For me, you know, you asked before about Midsummer. It's probably one of the reasons I'm sort of grappling with the decision of when is the right time to step down, and that is because that is just such a huge platform that's growing every year to create change. And I think, you know, to have 122 events in Midsummer this time, that's 122 people telling their story, that are educating people on what it is to be part of this community and in all different ways. And I think to continue to be able to build that platform and allow more people to come on, allow the story to reach more people, be able to promote those stories, I mean, that's a huge thing for me. And I think if I can continue to do that, I'm happy. I don't need to travel the world telling the stories or anything. I think just creating the platform for other people to drive that change is something that I'm probably more passionate about now than me necessarily being the face of driving the change.
Before you go, I just want to say, I really want to give you the opportunity to talk to the community. Is there a message you'd like to say to the community before we finish up?
Oh, if you're giving me a chance to get on my soapbox, I would love to say to the community, It is absolutely time for us to stand together. And I think one of the things that I find challenging about working in this community is the amount of times we're cutting each other down. And whether it's, you know, from one aspect of the community to another, or one organization to another, or, you know, I certainly think throughout Midsummer we have had more negativity over the years from our community than from people outside of our community. In fact, most of any interactions from outside of our community have been positive. The challenges we've faced are from criticism, negativity, tall poppy, if you like, from within this community. Not only that's my experience, but I see it across the communities all the time. I see one part dividing or cutting down another part or being derogatory towards other members of the community. And I think, you know, if we can't rely on each other to do that, and that's certainly one of the reasons we've really tried to pull Midsummer together and say we want everyone to be represented, because it doesn't matter if you're lesbian or gay or trans or intersex, or you're all part of this community. And if you can't rely on us to stand there in solidarity, then how on earth can we expect anyone outside of this community who haven't grown up with these challenges to even come close to standing with us? So, you know, cliche as it is, it's time to love each other, and it's time to stand united and really make sure that any member of our community is loved and supported by us all.
Well, John Corbell, I want to say thank you so much for joining us here today. Your story is incredible, and I love your mantra, share your story, and I hope you continue to do so, because I think it really does wake people up.
Thank you very much.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Benjamin Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Today's episode of Word for Word contained material that may deem triggering for some people. If this episode has affected you, please contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14. This message brought to you by Joy.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.